This is Burned by Books, a podcast for people stricken with what the Japanese call sundoku, or the acquiring of towers of reading material that you will never get to. We are here to help. I'm your host, Chris Holmes. I have a marvelous interview with Hermione Hobie, whose new novel, Virtue, is out today. If you don't already know Hermione from her knockout debut, Neon in Daylight, or her frequent work for The Guardian and The New Yorker, among others, then you're in for a real treat. What a fabulous writer and equally wonderful person. Before I get to the interview, I wanted to take a moment to address what is happening with COVID in the United States right now. As this podcast was begun as a way for me to preserve some sanity during the worst of the COVID epidemic, I feel compelled to place a historical marker at this moment when the brief period of hopefulness seems soon to be clouded over by a new round of infections, fear, and death. Only this time, it will be entirely of our making. We have a glut of vaccine, the world's riches of the most desperately needed scientific material. Had we rallied around the miracle that happened here and around the world, the production of the massively effective and wholly safe vaccine against COVID, we might have vaccinated every adult by the fall. The surging Delta variant that is running like wildfire through the world might not have found purchase here. But a brief look at our national infection rates show a different story. The initial surges of vaccinations have dwindled, most especially in red states, where the constant stream of lies about the risks and an unfathomable identification with the freedom in the choice to remain unvaccinated. Most recently and viciously, Tennessee has stopped promoting any vaccine and will no longer even perform the basic due diligence of reminding those with the first shot to get a second. The result is predictable and horrifying. The 3,000 and 4,000 cases daily we were seeing in June are now ready to once again crest 20,000. This is a particularly American self-destruction and a colossal failure of the states' rights experiment, where the malpractice of one state will end up killing many in the states who have followed scientific guidance and who, for the time being, have markedly lower rates of infection. For anyone who looks closely at the unique gun problem in our country, this devil's bargain, the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people traded for an individual's right to own and carry a deadly weapon, looks not unlike our own current predicament with COVID. I have, for nearly a decade, offered a class for first-year students at the college where I teach on gun violence in the U.S., and perhaps the most shocking and illuminating fact for my students is that the U.S., when compared to other affluent countries, is not appreciably more violent. Rates of domestic abuse, assault, and robbery are equivalent to places like the U.K. and Germany. What is monumentally different is that the rate of fatality in crimes committed here is so much higher. Our crime is simply much, much more deadly. That differential can be tracked as a causation between the number of unregulated guns that circulate in our country and the rates of crime that end in death, which almost always involve a gun. Despite our regular confrontation with mass murder by gun occurring now many times per month every year, we would prefer to maintain the illusion that an individual's freedom to own a gun is more valuable to the common good than the lives of 40 to 45,000 people who die from gun violence every year. If you're looking for an explanation as to why 30-odd percent of the country is unlikely to get vaccinated, even when their families' lives and their own lives are in direct jeopardy, follow the history of the gun in the U.S. Why talk about this on a books podcast? What's the point? What's a good outcome? Well, in a time of falsehood and artifice, fiction and poetry tell the truth. The writers I've had on this program are truth tellers, no matter the politics of the telling. It is as direct as Valjina Mort writing poetry to speak against the propaganda behind the anti-democratic government violence in Belarus, and to mourn those lost or imprisoned in the struggle against it. Or Alia Trabuco-Zaran, who refuses to let the Pinochet regime be softened as a new generation takes stock of his heinous crimes. And it is Alexander Chang facing micro and macro aggressions against Asian Americans head-on in her fiction about a writer's life. Rebecca Mackay found there was no great history of AIDS in Chicago, and so her novel gave life to history and made it no less true. Hermione Hobie's novel is as clear-eyed about our present moment as anything you'll find in long or short-form news, and Rumon Alam dramatized climate disaster in a novel about class and racial hatreds that structure American life. And I could go on and on. So where do we look for truth? Maybe art can cut through. One can only hope. Welcome back to Burned by Books. What a pleasure it is to welcome Hermione Hobie to the podcast. Hermione is the author of two novels, Neon and Daylight, which was a two-time New York Times Editor's Choice novel, and Virtue, which will be published July 20th with the wonderful Riverhead Books. Hermione grew up in Bromley in South London and graduated from the University of Cambridge. After working on The Observer's New Review, she moved to New York in 2010 and then subsequently relocated to Colorado. She has written for The Guardian, The New Yorker, The New York Times, Harper's, and others. And not for nothing, she has been photographed hanging out with Taylor Swift after an interview for The Guardian. Her new novel, Virtue, follows the post-university life of Luca, a 20-something with Dartmouth and Oxford degrees, working as an intern at a posh New York City literary magazine. Handsome and rudderless, Luca falls into the ken of a high-profile society couple who are artists with children from previous marriages as well as from their own. Paula and Jason are beautiful and talented, known and settled in the art scene of the city. They lead enviable lives and seem both fully in love with one another and engaged in the world. The American tragedy of the election of Donald Trump and the subsequent acts of resistance drive Luca to spend a summer of detached glories with the artist couple in their main summer home, where he discovers that their seeming perfection is a much-crafted illusion. During this visitation/invasion into a couple's life, Luca's mind returns regularly to his fellow intern, the brilliant and politically committed Zara, whose dedication to the newly evolving struggle for Black lives makes her both the object of his desire and curiosity, and the antithesis of everything he yearns for in the lives of Paula and Jason. The novel is encyclopedically contemporary in its vision of America. Little of the past 5 years escapes Hermione's critical gaze. The dark magic of the novel is that we are lulled into thinking that virtue is on the horizon, and that at least one of the characters to whom we are connected to can match the moment of crisis in the nation and world with virtue. The reality is, in fact, much too complicated for something as black and white as this. And when one character does indeed hold to its rigid standards, the consequences are heavy indeed. The resulting novel is a mesmerizing, beautifully imagined song for our difficult and fragile moment. There is great uncertainty, problematic desire, and the quest to be understood as meaningful. The book arrives with blurbs from no less than Gia Tolentino, Rachel Kushner, Leslie Jameson, and Joseph O'Neill. I have no doubt that Virtue will be on your must-reads for the summer. Welcome, Hermione Hobie.
Thank you so much, Chris. I feel sort of shaken in a good way by that incredibly generous and intelligent introduction. Thank you. I'm just trying to recover myself.
Well, I am so glad you're here. And I would love, if you would, for you to read from the beginning of the novel to set us with the scene and sound.
Of course. I will not sound like a 22-year-old American man, but
thank goodness.
Here he is. There's something kind of gratifying about a really bad birthday. Toward the garish end of 2016, the year our idols died, I turned 23 alone, failing to read a book in the dim, eggy light of a deserted Chinatown bar. I convinced myself that this stoically miserable, total non-event was preferable to drinks with a few people mustering faint cries of happy birthday, or God forbid, trying to sing the song always too slow, always going on longer than anyone wanted, particularly when groaning toward that final protracted lift on the first syllable of the penultimate birthday. I'd hoped that being alone might feel sort of heroic, or at least dignified, or at least grown up. It wasn't any of these things. It was the weekend before Thanksgiving, the end of the nothing month of November, and I remember raininess, a vague and unremitting overlay of pathetic fallacy. The sky had a passive-aggressive quality, bruised clouds withholding their light, while telling you they were fine, not to worry about them. They knew you didn't really care anyway. Ahead lay the grotesquerie of the reality star who'd soon be eating McDonald's and watching TV in the White House. It was a bad joke in the worst taste. The incoming president was the executive producer of The America Show, barreling faster toward the series finale, and the ratings would be great. Later, Zara would say in her deadly deadpan that the good ones had all pieced out because they knew what was coming. Prince, Bowie, Muhammad Ali. Names now, more than a decade later, half forgotten in a world too tyrannized by the present to have time for history. Should I stop there?
That's perfect. Thank you so much. You're so right about happy birthday, by the way. Whether that's just your opinion or just Luca's, I don't know, but I feel in concert with that. I love the opening of this novel, and it's wonderful to hear you read it. And in particular, there's a high-low vacillation there that's evocative of the style of the book as a whole. And the novel can be vulgar in the oldest sense of being of the body, while equally taking lyric turns at capturing the sweep of our contemporary moment. Were you purposeful with those swings in tone and voice and diction as you were writing the novel, or did it come more naturally as the narrative voice best suited to what was going on inside Luca?
Well, first, I'm so glad you picked up on that. That's really gratifying. So thank you. And my answer is going to be, I guess, a bit of a sort of tedious fudge, and a bit of both is the honest answer. So, that's the way I want to write. That seems like the most dynamic and truthful way to write. I want the high and the low. I want a kind of, an electric mix of it, if possible. But it also seemed suited to Luca in that he is someone whose self has formed in large part through books from a different time. You know, he's kind of fashioned his self-image on the kind of great American novels that we now regard with some suspicion, in that they are they are mostly about young men and masculinity. And so, a little later, actually, just a few pages on from this, Zara kind of teases him about talking like an old guy out of a book. Mm-hmm. So there is this, in one sense, he's sort of, old fashioned, but he is also very much, he's 23, a 23-year-old guy in 2017, and part of that world too. But I suppose the voice, I wanted the voice to be even more complicated by the fact that this is a retrospective narrative. So in a sense, we have him both 22 or 23, sorry, I keep getting his age wrong, both 23 and 33, 34, he's recollecting this time. And I wanted the 20-something Luca to actually sound kind of more old-fashioned, because he's, a little pretentious.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whereas the older Luca is sort of more contemporary and youthful sounding. So I wanted both, I wanted the mix of those two Lucas. And I did feel that this was kind of a way of having my cake and eating it too, in that this is a first-person narrative but there's something, I hope, of the, you know, something of the power of a third person, you mm-hmm. know, something more authorial, because it's Luca authoring himself, you know, it's him as a 30 something writing himself as a 20 something.
Yeah. As I was thinking about questions, I had to sort of stop myself and recall that it was a first person narrative, because in many ways it has more of a free and direct discourse feel, because there's, you know, Luca kind of self-censoring, commenting, reimagining that history. It's recent history, but history nonetheless.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's early sections of the novel are set amongst a gaggle of high-achieving interns at a prestige magazine in New York City. This is followed by an escape to the idols of Maine at a summer house. How mm-hmm. did you decide on these two pretty opposite American landscapes as your geographies?
I suppose whenever someone says, how did you choose or how did you decide? And I really don't mean to dodge this question, mm-hmm. but I think, well, I didn't really choose. I didn't really decide. You know?
They just went there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, intentionality is often kind of retroactive. As in, you know, the first stages of writing are, for me, I have to turn off the analytical and the self-censoring and follow intuition. And then, I mean, this is probably a, you know, woefully inefficient way of writing a novel. But then I switch on the, you know, the more analytical part and shape things. So I guess... I mean, the, you know, sort of topographically, those places are different, the Maine coastline and the, you know, sort of downtown Manhattan and the publishing world. But in a way, I felt like the same sensibilities were kind of moving through them in that, you know, Jason and Paula's house is in this little village in Maine. But they have, or rather Paula has encouraged a lot of her friends to get summer houses there. So it's almost like, you know, this kind of hegemony of, you know, New York living.
Well, there's that Bush compound, the former president's compound somewhere in Maine, which I'm sure.
Oh, geez. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, wow. I kept having flashes. I think it's in Kennebunkport, which is southern Maine. But yeah, I had flashes of that, what it was probably like based on what I had seen pictures of the Bush compound.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of tickled that, you know, there is a place in Maine called Brooklyn, L-A-N, and filled, it seems, in large part with people from Brooklyn.
Who just decided, let's just embrace the cliche of who and what we are as fully as possible.
Right, right. Phonetic consonants is, you know, that's the way to live. You just follow. Follow the phonetics. I don't know.
That's what they say. So as I was reading the insides of Luca's older and younger mind, I did wonder whether you had any misgivings or second-guessing yourself about your ability to get inside the head of an American man.
You know, perhaps I should have, but I did not. I mean, the novel began with his voice, just a very strong sense of his voice in my head, unignorable. And I had that really welcome, you know, delusion of feeling as though I were just dictating, particularly at the beginning, which isn't to say that then, you know, I didn't need years and years of refining and revising. But he just sort of presented himself to me. And, you know, I think gender is perhaps an easier thing to imagine than other kinds of difference. I mean, forgive me, this is going to be a little vulgar, quite literally of the body, but I found it much harder to, you know, I'm a lifelong vegetarian and mostly vegan. I found it much harder to embody a person eating a Whopper than to embody a person with a penis masturbating, you know? one of those things, yeah, that was like a real block. It was like, okay, this is my biggest challenge, to imagine eating and enjoying some dead cow. So that, you know, that particular moment was way harder than, I don't know, imagining boners or, you know, just what it is to be a dude.
I have to say, your saying the word does not convince me of the of that being within your lexicon. But there is that moment where he's describing kind of the pleasure and self-disgust of eating the Whopper on the right. The roadside stop, right. That he has, and I thought that it was very true to my own experience of, you know, it's not necessarily one's plan to eat that, but then when offered that choice, you do go to the like pleasure and disgust of those roadside places.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I also, you know, just to write as a man just felt very liberating. And I don't even mean that necessarily in a political way, but more, I knew that no one would mistake me for a 23-year-old guy from Broomfield, Colorado. And that just gave things a sense of, I don't know, momentum and kind of purity. You know, I felt exempt. There was going to be no biographical confusion, no biographical readings here. And that felt really wonderful.
Yeah. And that's interesting because so many of the interviews I've done so far on the podcast have had significant sections where we were talking through the anxieties of that biographical overlap and what it meant to be either wanting to write autofiction or wanting to be very separate from that category. And so I see what you're saying about the a freedom and a path ahead that doesn't have those particular anxieties.
I'm a, you know, hugely enthusiastic reader of good autofiction, and I think there is a lot of good autofiction. I have also felt, you know, particularly in recent years, a kind of hunger for the novel in which, for the kind of novel in which the world and intimate lives are imbricated. And, you know, I mean, there are so many novels I've loved, you know, recent contemporary novels that don't do that. So I don't mean to be, you know, throwing shade at anyone.
No.
but I have just felt a real appetite for, you know, the sorts of books in which we have a sense of, well, yeah, to use, I guess, Lucas' phrase, which is a bit cringe of me, but the small world and the large world, you know, how these, the kind of macro forces at play in America and beyond, cannot be separated from individuals' lives and, you know, their intersubjectivities too.
Absolutely. I remember hearing Jonathan Safran Foer read from Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close at the Harvard Bookstore in 2005 and thinking that it was equal parts brave and foolish to attempt to gain a vantage on the natural national tragedy of 9/11 when it was still so fully occupying our present. Virtue likewise braves the contemporary, but with even less of a gap in the time for reflection. What was it like to try and situate the novel in our precise zeitgeist? Trump, the Women's March, BLM movement, Charlottesville, even as that zeitgeist was morphing under your feet?
It's a wonderful question. The short answer is, really, really hard. But let me try and give you something, a longer answer. I guess my longer answer is, I think we, and I have been guilty of this, we have a sort of naive belief that whatever narrative solidifies is the true historical narrative. And, you know, particularly in terms of racial politics, this has been, you know, I've welcomed the interrogating and dismantling of such a notion. But I think, you know, the reason people think it's hard to write about recent events is that we haven't processed them. We don't know what they are yet. And that's true. But I also think we don't know what they are 10 years later or 20 years or 30 years. We never really know what they are. It's just that our sense of what they are, the meaning we've ascribed them, changes and shifts. And so in a way, you know, a take 1 year on, and I'm sorry to use such a crude term, maybe I don't mean take, an interpretation is perhaps just as valid as one that comes 10 years later, because both of those are, you know, rife with subjectivity and fallible in different ways.
That's right.
But, you know, all that's to say, it certainly was an extremely difficult thing to be trying to get some sense of traction when, as you say, the ground was shifting and things are changing, and not only changing, but at such an accelerated rate. I mean, I feel like, particularly under the last president, and forgive me, I find it hard to say his name out loud. As you know, there's no problem with saying Bona or whatever, but there are some vulgarities that I feel cannot be uttered on your blessed podcast. You know, those years, the news was just at warp speed. There was a relentlessness. And so it was, I mean, my friend, a great writer and a great guy, David Bergerard, had a tweet that went viral that was something along the lines of future historians will be asked to say which quarter or which period of 2016, I think they specialized in, or maybe it was 2020. Anyway, his point was, you know, there has just been so much happening. And I have wondered how we will historicize, you know, which bits of the previous administration will kids be taught? What will solidify and endure?
Yeah, and what will get lost? And in a way, the fact that you do grab up both the sort of the literal events, but also the like sensations of it and the moments of outrage and horror and wanting to flee and those kind of the feelings and the affects of the time are something that I think literature is so important for capturing.
Oh, I completely agree, Chris. Yes, you're singing to the choir in that particular one. Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, that's one of the myriad reasons we need novels, and why I, you know, believe wholeheartedly in literature. I'm a zealot in that regard.
Me too. And I think of Ali Smith, who's produced one of the great experiments with hyper contemporaneity in her Seasonal Quartet, as someone who is trying to depict the very events unfolding around her as she writes them. Did you see, or do you see, Virtue as participating in this kind of hyper contemporaneity, or do you simply think that we're called to, at this moment, write and produce art that is about our absolute moment?
I should say I hear wonderful things about this quartet, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't read it, which is something I must correct.
I think you would love it. I do recommend it.
I will put it on the list. Yeah, add it to the pile. Huh, I guess I hadn't thought of myself as being part of that project. And I know, again, a book I hear good things about that I haven't read, Olivia Lang's Crudo, seems to be working in that vein as
Absolutely.
Well. Absolutely. Yeah. I think I'm wary of issuing any kind of statement along the lines of, you know, this is what a writer's duty is, this is what a writer should do. I certainly felt it was like what I had to do, and what I wanted to do. I think I'm drawn to our present, and I'm in awe of people who write historical novels. I wouldn't know how to do that. I feel... Mm-hmm. I don't know. I tend to feel seized by the present. And I suppose, you know, writing fiction is sort of the most honest, and the hardest way, I have of like being in the world and living in the world and, being awake.
One of the things that you sort of grab up in that contemporary gaze is the Women's March. And this is the second recent novel that I've read that sort of takes it on directly. And frankly, in both, it doesn't come off in a terribly good light, or at least not an uncomplicated light. Did it feel like you were sacrificing a totem of liberalism to complicate this now iconic moment of resistance?
I imagine the first novel is Lauren Euler's brilliant Skewering. Is that
you
right?
You are correct. You are very correct.
Yeah. Well, the phrase you use, sacrificing a totem of liberalism, it's stirring. And so I want to say, yes, goddammit, that's what I was doing. It sounds valiant and sort of ruthless. One thing I was thinking a lot while writing this novel was the question of taste, and how that is a politically tricky thing, as in so much of the outrage over the previous president was to do with his vulgarity. You know, he looked gross. He was trashy. He was orange. He, you know, was like nouveau riche and clearly had terrible taste. And of course, those were not his greatest crimes, you know?
So you say.
Right. That wasn't the biggest problem. And so I think, and this was, you know, this was actually something I talked quite a lot to my partner, Ben, about. And so I think you know, the thing that I found so gross about the Women's March were those stupid, ugly hats. And this is very low of me because I then, you know, it's like, this isn't about taste.
You're going to get hate mail now, Hermione.
Oh, God. But I, you know, it's like, who cares? But I think, let me try and, climb out of this hole. I've just dug myself. The hats, who cares? But they are a problem if all people care about is the hats. And, you know, there's just a kind of self-congratulation on like knitting the hat and taking your selfie and going on the march, but you don't actually do anything. And this isn't to say I don't believe in protest. I think protest is beautiful and a valid political weapon. I have just sensed that, you know, at this time of kind of rabid and relentless social media and personal branding and all these other, you know, omnipresent evils, it is easy for our politics to take on the quality of sort of sensationalism and lookism. It's about looking good. And I think it's easy then for people to kind of let themselves off the hook. You know, if they go on the march and take a picture, then whatever, they can, you know, not actually engage with their own community or, you know, do anything else. So I guess I feel ambivalent about the Women's March. I found it very stirring at the time. I remember actually the day of it, I'd gone to DC to march and then I was really sick. So I watched it like lying on a sofa on my laptop, but I have, you know, I have very vivid memories of just seeing these scenes unfold, and I felt I did find it very moving at the time. It, I don't know what it did, you know, and it's very hard with all these things to, you know, find the metrics. Like, how would we know exactly what it did? You know, how exactly to track the efficacy of marches and other forms of protest. They don't sort of neatly produce better policy in some kind of, you know, clear, traceable, direct line.
Yeah, it's hard to aggregate their exactly. value. Yeah. And it will be, you know, historians who sort of take apart what the kind of minutiae of its value is, or whether it had a different role in changing the again the sort of sensation of the moment. But while we're on the subject, I really think of your novel as taking a steel-toed boot to the soft bits of white liberalism, particularly the performativity of it, which I think you've just addressed with the pink hats. Paula and Jason are each in their own way a version of the failure of this kind of liberalism. In Paula's case, she believes her art can speak to the moment in a way that will be more meaningful than getting angry at the state of things, while Jason fumes at injustice but is mostly impotent in acting out the intensity of his feelings. Can you talk a little bit about how these two characters came into focus for you, and how the failure of liberalism to hold tightly to any virtue became a pathos for the novel?
Absolutely. I don't mean to flatter you, Chris, but it is really wonderful to hear you use that phrase, you know, the failure of liberalism as a kind of, to hold tightly to virtue is the pathos of the novel. I agree with that. I would also say, though, that I love these two. I love Jason. Mm-hmm. I love all the characters. And I do think there is certainly a harshness in the novel. I was certainly feeling a great deal of anger, as I'm sure, you know, most people in America were for varying reasons. But I really don't blame these two. And I had this sense of them as being, you know, good and fallible people. I have sympathy with Paula when she's like, well, I'm an artist. I'm not an organizer. I'm not going to run for office. That's just not who she is. And I have sympathy for Jason too, when he's feeling rage and a kind of guilt over his, you know, pleasant, wealthy lifestyle, which is down in large part to his wife. And, you know, as the feminist he is, he can't really acknowledge that, because politically and intellectually he's cool with his wife, you know, earning or having more money than he is. But there is still, you know, as with all of us, a kind of atavistic part that we're less inclined to examine or sort of give credence to. I guess we're talking about two different things, the failure of liberalism and the kind of utility of art. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the latter, I absolutely believe in the kind of necessity of art, not just the utility. And I guess the term utility is, you know, the wrong one. Like, that's the point. It's not about utility. I was, you know, recently with the Gaza conflict, I was thinking about social media, as I tend to do. And I was like, isn't it kind of crass and disgusting? I think I'd taken like a cute picture of our cat or something. I was like, isn't it totally tone deaf to post a picture of my cat while this is happening? And then I kind of thought, you know, the whole point of not being bombed and having rights and not living in a war zone and all the rest is so one can take pleasure in one's cat or whatever, you know, fill in that gap. And I think the same is true of art. It's like, yes, of course, you know, our basic human needs are more important than whatever, going to the opera. But the point of being alive is, you know, the point of having a good life in a good society is that there is then room to be human in the fullest way. And being human in the fullest way means, to my mind at least, art, you know. So I really forgive Jason and Paula. And it has been interesting, actually, you know, with the few friends who've read it, to receive their very different reactions to these characters. And, you know, some people just find them vile and despicable, and others just kind of, you know, swept up in their romance. And
I think they're very much both. I mean, you sort of both see exactly why Luca is sort of drawn into the whirlpool of their energy and their artistic production and their intellectualism and their beauty. They're just sort of physical and ephemeral beauty. And at the same time, like, I felt a kind of sort of righteous anger at them at many times during the novel.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And since we're on the topic of art and its necessity while not being utilitarian, there are real moments where I wondered what your thoughts were on the value of art in times of precarity. And at times it seemed that you were saying, well, the novel is saying, but perhaps you are also saying that art can be really fraudulent and it can skim along the surface of commercial value and hipness and fail all the other big things that we want it to do.
Absolutely. You know, I remember my friend Christine Smallwood, who, by the way, has just written an excellent novel, which I wholeheartedly recommend. She wrote a piece years and years ago about the kind of sudden ubiquity of like tote bags and stuff that said, I love books and I love reading. And she had this really elegant phrase, the curiously undifferentiated flavor. And I just love that phrase. Hmm. And I think,
I like that.
Yeah, it's good, right? It's like, yeah, I believe in art. But when I say that, I mean, I believe in good art. And I don't, you know, like most art, unfortunately, is bad. And, you know, most novels are bad. And the ones that are good are extraordinarily, one, you know, they're sacred things. And they're my reason for staying alive. And I hope other people's reasons for staying alive as well. So I absolutely believe in art, but yeah, there's a lot of bad art, mm-hmm. you know, in every medium. That's why it was important that I wanted to have that scene in which Luca, he goes uptown. I don't name them as Cy Twombly's, but I think it's not going to destroy anything to say that's what they are. He goes sees these Cy Twombly paintings, and I wanted him to have, you know, a genuinely pure, rhapsodic, meaningful response to these extraordinary paintings. Yeah, it was really important that scene was in the book. But also, you know, there's something sort of self-evident, I hope, in that, sure, this is a novel preoccupied with, you know, this question of art, its decadence or its validity. But it's a novel that I wrote, and it took a long time to write. So you know what I mean? Like, that's your proof.
Yeah, absolutely.
I believe in the novel.
You've committed. You've put it on the page.
Yeah, I don't mean to be saying, you know, this is good art and I believe in the good art of my novel, but I believe in the novel as form. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I committed indeed.
you know, Jason and Paula are sort of fabulously sexy, and mm-hmm. the fact that you've given the sort of sexual energy and center of the novel to people in their late 40s, I think is actually, unfortunately, quite a rarity. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, were you wanting to kind of play with the stereotypes of age and sexuality, which, you know, so often, you know, everything is given to the young, to the 20s and 30s. And then everything else is seen as neutered and yeah. interesting, but not for reasons of sexuality.
Sure. Yeah. I think maybe I'm going to sound like Luca now, but I think there's nothing sexier than a sexy woman in her 40s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think, you know, I mean, to me, sexiness is so much about that person's self-possession and self-knowledge and power. And, you know, that's hard to come by, and it tends to take some decades. So, you know, I guess I hadn't thought about, I don't know, like countering a stereotype or whatever, speaking up for the sexiness of the older lady. But, you know, my life is full of very sexy people in their 40s. So, I'm glad you find them sexy.
Yeah, well, and I think that, you know, to have a 20-something's gaze be in that direction, I found powerful, and I agree that it is their self-possession and their confidence and the years of working through kind of hard things to learn about yourself that makes them interesting.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that. I mean, and not to kind of throw the two of them under the bus, but I would say it is also, and this is the, you know, the queasy, tricky, like icky kind of thing that I wanted to try and write about. It is all that. It is all those good, undeniable things. It is also their wealth, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like,
yes.
One, it's easier to be self-possessed and carefree and confident when you've got money. And this is a very distasteful truth. So I wanted Luca to be anxious about, you know, what is the difference between beauty and just money? There's one moment where he's in their house, in their Brooklyn house, and He's kind of staring at these fancy candles, which are, you know, filling the air with this gorgeous scent. And, you know, he's kind of wondering, is this beauty or is this just having the money to spend on really posh, expensive candles? And I'm sure people will know which candles I'm talking about, which I do. I also love them. But, you know, it's a kind of, it's a ridiculous thing.
Yeah, the economics of what gets to stand in for sexy is it's never not followed by the flip side of the coin, being that you know, the inequalities that allowed it to be a symbol of sexiness it's always there.
Exactly. Yeah.
So nearly everyone in the novel of consequence is either an artist or art curious. And you have these wonderfully beautiful, smart interns at what's called the New Old World magazine, which includes Luca. And I wondered if your experience with magazines had brought any of the sort of the feel and the vibe of these sort of young people feeling both utterly completely compelled by the excitement and the literariness and the chicness of working at something like this magazine, which feels very much like the New Yorker, whether your own experiences with magazines had influenced that or whether you were sort of drawing from something more imaginary.
Yeah, I guess I'd say, you know, I've never worked at one of these magazines. I've never been an intern at such a magazine. But, you know, they have been sort of part of my world, just kind of socially or I don't know, quasi-professionally. But I suppose I was drawing more on the imaginary. I guess one thing I was thinking about was where as a young person you get your sense of authority from, and the way that these kind of prestige publications can present an authority and a kind of infallibility that of course is false. You know, they are just subjective and limited and, you know, often politically short-sighted and, you know, beholden to advertisers and readership and whatever the, you know, the whims of the board and all that stuff. So there is no fixed authority to these places. And which isn't to say that, you know, they aren't valuable, and can't be of great cultural importance. But I did have a sense, you know, this is ongoing, that we are in a moment of such enormous change that all institutions are having to, reckon with their own histories and and sort of what their point is right now, because it can't be the kind of soothing self-congratulation that has possibly characterized some of these institutions, you know.
Well, you show the magazine at a moment of real kind of fracture. It doesn't come off particularly well, and in part because that there's an aspect of its prestige that requires it to kind of sit you know, dancing above the fray, where it wants to be, when its own writers and thinkers kind of want to pull it down into the meaty, fraught now, it wants to balk at that.
Right. I think one of the great problems I've been wrangling with this last half decade or whatever is just that the demands, like the world of art makes different demands than the world of politics and civic duty. And so, you know, I think a novel is an amoral space, but a magazine, it's an interesting entity in that it is a, you know, a conduit and a vessel for art, but it's also potentially a political tool. And I haven't solved this problem. You know, I don't know what a magazine should be. And I find it a fascinating question. I guess it's going to be quite amazing these next few years to see what, you know, these magazines become and what their mission is.
I wonder if we'll recognize whatever it is that they become as the thing that we've been living with and kind of counting on in some ways to sort of be literary tastemakers.
Right. And, you know, when I believe in art, and I don't think art, I think dogmatic art is not art, but I do think art, good art, tends to be political in that it is engaging, you know, with the exigencies of our world. But I don't want manifestos, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll take a manifesto in whatever nonfiction form, but you know, we need stories that are just stories too.
No, novels that are, you know, act as manifestos are almost exclusively very, very bad.
Yeah, I think they're just not novels.
Yeah, that's true. So in terms of your writing for magazines, you have sort of this unbelievable list of people that you've interviewed and profiled over the years, contemporary writers, artists, actors, Toni Morrison. I'm making all sorts of, like, you know, movements with my hands that you can't see because I find that so unbelievably one. Yeah, exactly.
That's the correct response.
That is the correct response. Jeffrey Eugenides, Katie Kitamura, Ann Patchett, the director, Patty Jenkins, actors, Natasha Lyonne, John Boyega, Jennifer Lawrence, and Mindy Kaling, and on and on. I particularly recommend to everyone who's listening your profile of the South African writer, Ivan Vladislavich.
Thanks.
Having truly made a really marvelous career from talking with artists of enormous fame, what makes a good interview, especially when you're talking to someone that the public believes they already know?
Yeah, good question. Well, not the fact that they're famous. That is not what makes a good interview. And I know that's not what you were saying. I didn't mean to sound like I'm scolding you. But what I've loved about doing this kind of work is it's the same reason I love writing novels. I just love people. I hopelessly love my species, and I feel so greedy for them, for just the you know, every inimitable person in their personhood. That to me is just like an endlessly thrilling thing. What makes a good interview? Well, you're doing a very good one right now, so maybe you should answer. I'm sorry, I'm being facetious. I guess, you know, a true curiosity and openness, and then an honesty in the writing. And this gets complicated when, as you say, there is a sense, you know, there's a kind of entrenched narrative of who that person is and what they mean and what their significance is. So I guess I've always tried to think about that narrative as its own thing, and like what purpose that might be serving, which is almost separate from the subject themselves, because, you know, it's interesting too, you know, why it is that so-and-so has been seized as emblematic of something or other, even if they're not.
Well, I'm going to make you and I a t-shirt that says, "I hopelessly love my species." and I feel like it will catch on. And
dork, isn't it?
It is, but it's really wonderful. And I think, you know, from my own kind of take on interviewing, I feel like if you don't have that going on, you're going to be incredibly boring, because you're not really going to care what the person has to say about anything.
I mean, I think that's the key thing. I really do care. I really just care about people. I don't just mean the people in my life that I love, but I mean people. I'm like, whatever, I, you know, go buy a coffee and I'm like, who is this guy in the bodega? You know, it's thrilling to me. Human beings are thrilling to me. Yeah.
Well, you have a lot of visual artists in that kind of gallery of wonderful interviews. And I wonder if any of them influenced your depictions of artists in Virtue.
I guess the sort of artists that I were that were kind of swirling in my mind as I sort of built Paula or listened to Paula or, you know, allowed Paula to become more Paula were people I haven't interviewed. And maybe I shouldn't name them actually, because I think I want to, you know, preserve that space. And I know I just named the Cy Twombleys and Luca going to look at the Cy Twombleys, but
it's too late.
I've rumbled myself. But the reason I don't, you know, explicitly name him in the book is that, you know, if you've seen Cy Twombleys, you have ideas about them. Maybe you don't like them. If you don't know who Cy Twombly is, you might be like, oh, I'm whatever, this book's like excluding me, you know. So I wanted I wanted him not to be named, so that there is that space for someone to imagine and, you know, make it their own. Because that to me, I mean, not to sound like a total sap, but that to me is what is so magical about reading fiction. It is that dynamic between what the writer is offering you and then what you bring to it, you know. Yeah. So you imagine the character is, I don't know, that person you went to school with or whatever, and it becomes so deeply personal because it is an imaginative act on your part as a reader as well.
Yeah, and they can contain multitudes, and those many, many different artist amalgams can be important to the reader, putting them together. So I agree that, you know, too much sort of citing of people and artists can contract that ability to have a full imaginative experience with it.
Yeah, and you know, that was one of the reasons I don't have acknowledgements in the book as well. It's not because I'm not hugely grateful to a host of people who will be receiving, you know, individual handwritten notes upon publication. It's more that I just don't want to break that fourth wall. I don't want the interruption of real life and, you know, real Googleable people into this imagined world. I want to preserve that.
So it's finally summer. It's completely beautiful here. I hope it is in Colorado as well.
It really is.
Oh, good.
Really
is. After a winter of Game of Thrones proportions. Can we talk about your summer reading plans and what do you have on your must-read lists? And are there forthcoming books that you had a peek at that you would recommend, as well as things that are maybe already on shelves?
Oh, sure. Always a pleasure to talk books. Well, I am just, you know, continuing the project of trying to correct my great ignorance, and one of the lacuna I'm trying to plug this summer is just a lot of Frankfurt School stuff. So, you know, in an unforgivable fun, I'm just privately, well, now publicly, embarrassingly, deeming this my Frankfurt summer school. not okay.
That's the second t-shirt I'm going to make for you.
Maybe that could be a baseball cap.
Cap goes with it.
So I'm reading Adorno, which is just mind-blowing and staggeringly wonderful, and feels like, you know, lifting heavy weights. And then I'm also reading Willa Cather, which is just like a stroll. If we're continuing the exercise analogy, yes, it's like strolling in the park. Willa Cather feels like children's literature, and I mean that in the best way, in that it's just, there's just something so soothing about it. I'm also like, you know, choking on these moments of really shocking racism. But I don't think that's reason not to read her. I don't need my writers to be good. I really don't need them to be good. I loved Sally Rooney's forthcoming novel.
You've already read it.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh, I'm so terribly jealous.
You should be. it's truly wonderful.
What's the title of it again? I forget.
Beautiful World, comma, Where Are You? No question mark.
Okay.
it's gorgeous.
Genius.
Really genius, just an extraordinary writer. And then another, a page turner, but, you know, tonally diametric is Josh Cohen's brilliant, the Netanyahu's. He too is just such a crackling genius in a very different way.
The so Netanyahu's, really huh?
Netanyahu's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's excellent. I have this essay collection that I hear really great things about. Jesse McCarthy's Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul,
okay.
Which I hear is brilliant. So I'm looking forward to reading that.
Oh, he has a brand new or forthcoming novel, isn't that right?
He does. Yeah, with Melville House. Yeah. I can read that too. I love Miyako Kawakami, so I've got Heaven, her most recent novel, my novel as well. Let's see what else. I also, speaking of lacunae and filling them, I've only ever read Baldwin's nonfiction, so I'm gonna read Giovanni's Room.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You're in for an incredible treat.
Yeah. Yeah, that really does feel like quite a shameful one, actually, not having read his fiction. So seeking to correct that.
Have you read Convenience Store Woman by Morata? If you're a fan of Breast and Eggs and Heaven, it's quite different, but they share some interesting sensibilities. So I definitely suggest it. And it's like you can sit down and read it in 45 minutes, but it's beautiful and startling and strange and different than probably a lot of things you've read recently.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. No, I must put that on the list. Thank you. Oh, I'm also really excited about Claire Sestanovich's, what is her debut collection called? Objects of Desire, I think.
Okay.
I really, really enjoyed her stories in The New Yorker. So I think that's going to be a treat. Probably countless other things that I will remember as soon as we get off the call. But
well, those sound wonderful. I'm gonna put them right up on the website. I think it's fantastic that you're using the summer for Adorno. I'm so sad to say that the last minute of my conversation with Hermione was cut short by a strange audio bug in the system. She was, at the end, as graceful and poised and witty as she was at the beginning of the interview, and I hope that you will go to burnedbybooks.com to see the whole of her summer reading recommendations and also find a link with which to purchase Virtue from Buffalo Street Books. Thank you so much. Well, that's it for our show today. My many thanks to Hermione Hobie for a wonderful conversation and for her new novel, out today, Virtue. The next episodes will feature Brian Hall, whose new novel, The Stone Loves the World, is the big family epic that you've been waiting for, and Katie Kitamura, whose newest novel, Intimacies, is taking the literary world by storm. Until then, this has been Burned by Books.